Hello, everybody, and welcome again to another Dawn of the Golden Age. I just want to recap, really, before we get introduced to Charles and remind ourselves of what we heard last week with episode number one, which was coming from Yvonne Yamani Lee from Hong Kong. And it's been a week now since I heard her message, and I still contemplate it every day. But what I'm realizing now, and this is only my own opinion, that the terms and conditions that the Hong Kong people are insisting upon could well be a template for this new paradigm, this new harmony that we are edging our ways towards. And what these people of Hong Kong are fighting on behalf of is not only their own liberty and free expression, but also to set in motion some infectious change that could come to us all based on these same principles. And so today, it is with huge admiration that we're going to speak to Charles Eisenstein, author of many books, but the most recent, or the one I'm reading at the moment, is Climate, A New Story. And the theme I chose for Charles is naturally something along the lines of ecocide. But I just want to bring in a little something that's fresh for me. And this was about 2 weeks ago. I was over in Budapest in Hungary. And the evening sky was catching my attention. It was a sort of uncomfortable orange. And I spoke to my friends who live there. And I said, what is it with the sky? What is this kind of yucky orange? And why is there a great ring right in the center of it all? And she explained that this was the electrosmog. It was all the routers and all the Wi-Fis from the inhabitants. And because Budapest is such a beautiful city, it totally lit up every single night, especially the Houses of Parliament. And all of that electricity, because of the river, is storing above the river and causing this really weird orange glow. And the way she explained it to me was as if it was normal and natural. And of course, the following evening, I was really keen to see whether it was there again, and it was. And the ring was exactly in the same place. And so I would love to go over now to Charles to speak on beyond this point and for us to hear his freshest contemplations and also hopefully to leave us lingering in a field of hope and faith. And maybe this won't be our hope and faith, but a hope and faith that we carry for the generations to come. So, Charles, it is my honor to sit back and listen to what you'd love to share with us.
Thank you, Anaya. I'm really happy to be in this conversation. As you were speaking about the demonstrators in Hong Kong and this feeling that what they are yearning for is much more than anything that could be framed in political terms. This is also the feeling I got at Occupy Wall Street years ago. It's the feeling I got when I visited Extinction Rebellion in Berlin and spoke there, that the proximate demands that they're making, the things that they can even put into the language of a demand, aren't really why they are there. And that I even said this to the Extinction Rebellion people. I was like, if tomorrow, if the IPCC announced that actually we were wrong and the climate isn't warming after all, greenhouse gases aren't a problem, I said, you wouldn't just go home satisfied that civilization is on the right track, because climate change is just a symptom of a much deeper condition. I would say a sickness, but I don't actually frame it fully in terms of a sickness. It's more of an evolutionary process that is reaching a point now where it's ready to transform. So it's basically a Extinction Rebellion, and I think that this is something animating all of these protests around the world, an understanding, a recognition that the world could be so much more beautiful than it is today, that all of our systems need to change. And when I say need to change, what do I mean by that? It's not need to change so that we will survive. It is need to change so that they can come into alignment with who we are becoming. Not to be too cliche about talking about a shift in consciousness or anything like that, but it is happening. And we are, as we move more into a consciousness of compassion, of interconnection, empathy, and all that comes with it, the generosity, the forgiveness, the trust, the participation in nature rather than the domination of nature. As we our consciousness moves into that, our legacy systems are increasingly inhospitable to who we are becoming. And I think that on one level, like all of these protests are tapping into that yearning to evolve our systems in alignment with who we are becoming. Because it's not like in Hong Kong, I don't think if you really are, if you got deep into the conversation, it's not like the financial oligarchs of Hong Kong are going to be necessarily any better than the communist Chinese. It's not, or any better than the British were. It's not about, like, if you, any demand, even if you take it as far as full independence, that's not really what we want. What we want cannot even be demanded because it is not within the power of authority to grant us. That's not how the change is going to happen. So, speaking to the electrosmog, when you told me the story before we recorded, you said you said so despite this horrible electrosmog thing, which probably, I'm thinking probably has a lot to do with light pollution as well, which is actually one of the main causes some people think of the decline in insects worldwide. Anyway, whatever is causing it, at the same time as this tragic data point that you're receiving, you said that the gathering itself was so full of love, right? And that's a data point too. We're having, at least I'm having, and I think a lot of people share this, more and more interactions, more and more gatherings, more and more relationships that are really partaking in a new story of who we are and what the world is and what the world can be. And every time that I mean, even like my own children, the things that they are aware of were just not even in existence when I was that age. My one son talking about, he's in a new school, having trouble making friends, but, is that really the people there, or am I playing out some blockage in myself, some resistance to being close to people, like that kind of thinking. I didn't learn that till I was 35. And so this next generation is understanding it right away. It's second nature. So when I'm facing the future and invited into despair, I always ask, does my despair include all of the data points? Does it include all of the information? Or am I building a case for hopelessness that only includes the electrosmog and the whale deaths and the coral reef deaths and the Amazon burning and all that? Am I including the miracles? Am I including the most sublime experiences that I've had? Am I including these encounters with young people who are so highly conscious of things that I didn't even have an inkling of at that age? Like, am I including all of these things? If I'm not, if I'm leaving some of them out, then I have to say that my despair is irrational.
Mm.
Where is it coming from? Maybe it's coming from an internal wound. Maybe I need to paint a picture of despair in order to give outlet to my grief and to my bewilderment. But it's not reality. And I think ultimately we have to bring in all of our world into our awareness in order for us to act appropriately. We have to be in reality, not excluding the good and not excluding the bad either.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, what else can I say about that? Do you have a comment you want to make?
I find it absolutely fascinating to hear you speak about these data points, about evaluating the whole picture. And I absolutely loved what you were saying. I must say it's gone from me now because it was so cutting edge. When I replay, I will hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just with you on the track that you're taking.
I've been thinking a lot about a quote from Carl Sagan. Do you remember Carl Sagan, the astronomer?
No.
He was an astronomer, and he did a public television series called Cosmos. And on the one hand, he was a very rational scientist, very orthodox in his scientific views. Didn't, believe that there was anything but matter. And yet he also had the heart of a mystic, and he spoke so beautifully about the universe. Like, you could tell that he was really in religious awe of creation.
Yes.
And one of his lines was, sailors on a becalmed sea, we sense the stirring of a breeze. And it takes me to this this sense that our culture, or even our civilization, is stuck.
Mm-hmm.
That we've exhausted all of our, like the wind has left our sails and we're adrift, and we don't know where we're going anymore. We can't even imagine what we want to get to, that the old ambitions that were so vital and alive in the 1950s and the 1960s, the glorious destiny of humanity to complete the conquest of nature, to break through every frontier, to harness the power of the atom, to go off into space, the visions of robot servants and bubble cities and the cure for all disease, this whole thing, it has not manifested. And instead, we no longer have a sense of mission and collective purpose and a collective sense of why we're here and what our future is. And so that's kind of this being adrift.
Mm.
And now something else as we let go of the these old destinies, something begins to stir.
Mm.
And we tentatively open our sails to catch a different breeze that may take us to a different place. Yeah. We were, I'm trying to remember, you had wanted me to talk about, well, I could talk about a lot of things. We were going to talk about climate, maybe?
I'd like to come back. I can remember what it was that really took my breath away when you were speaking about the people from Hong Kong and Extinction mm-hmm. Rebellion. And I know many of those people. And you're absolutely right. We cannot put word to what we are protesting against. And you're absolutely right. If Extinction Rebellion was granted all of their wishes and there was this emergency response from worldwide government to address the climate issue, that would so not satisfy. It doesn't even come close.
Right.
So when you spoke like that, a huge light went off inside of me. You're right. We cannot yet word it. And maybe we cannot fully yet understand it. And yet it exists and we're all feeling it.
Right.
And this unrest, but it's a joyful unrest. It's not uncomfortable. It's exciting and something's happening. I personally feel it everywhere, in relationship, in family life, certainly in political life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happens then? Because what we really want, what we're really protesting against or working for is not something that we can put in even into words, let alone into political words. There's a discomfort with that thing. And an urgency. That urgency is supposed to be, it's like the true spirit of urgency is to feel the necessity to bring parts of yourself into alignment that are not in alignment. Like to bring your life into alignment with your values, for example, that creates a sense of urgency, but it gets channeled onto hurry. And when it gets channeled onto hurry out of fear, then we end up enacting familiar solutions because those are the only ones that are quickly available. And that might mean giving more power to the people who can implement those solutions. And the risk then is to end up repeating the kinds of solutions that are actually part of the problem. And I think that for Extinction Rebellion, I think that, as you say, not only would the fulfillment of their demands not really meet the real issue, like would it solve the, you know, prison industrial system? Would it make that go away? Would it eradicate misogyny? Would it change the sweatshop factory system that exploits people all over the world? Would it stop imperial coups and regime change operations, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And would it change the basic mindsets that are underneath all of those things? Probably not. Not only that, but it might actually make things worse because a lot of the most readily accessible ways that are on the political radar to reduce carbon emissions and bring down CO2 levels actually could make things worse. And in some places are making things worse, such as industrial scale biofuels, mega dams that are destroying like the biggest wetlands in Africa, like all kinds of you know, whole forests are getting fed into wood chip factories to make supposedly carbon neutral fuel. And when these are enforced, when these kinds of solutions, okay, you know, higher fuel taxes, and when they are enforced on people who are already barely making it economically, you see what happens. You know, when a lot of the protest movements around the world actually start with fuel hikes, fuel price hikes, because people are in desperate situations. And if that's not recognized, so poverty, you know, is that going to be solved? So if that's not, so basically the problem is everything.
Yeah.
But can you demand change everything? And is demand even the right word? Because demand says do it or else. But we're not actually in, we meaning those who are envisioning a more beautiful world. We're not actually in a position where we can make demands on somebody.
Yeah.
So anyway, I didn't mean to like go so much into Extinction Rebellion, but the basic principle of maybe what we need is a pause. Maybe what we need is to slow down and not do things faster.
Yeah.
Because we're stuck in the patterns of reactivity and the patterns of response and the patterns of fear that underlie the problem to begin with. Yeah.
I was just thinking, you know, with the little bit of time we got left, I really wanted to keep these to 30 minutes so that we don't lose anyone along the way. as I came away from Yvonne, this idea that the terms and conditions, that the Hong Kongers are working on our throat and putting into word this sense of liberty and expression. So what do you feel we are being edged into with the plight of the natural world and our absolute disharmonization with it currently? So what is this backing us? We're being backed into a corner. What is the sentence that the natural world and all its inhabitants could be saying to us with this edging and backing into the corner? As you're quite right, it's not a demand. Of course, it's not a demand. Yeah. The world will be absolutely fine without us. And we've, you know, in my opinion, we've been here five times before anyway.
Oh, boy, there's so much there. I'll try to be brief. I don't think that the natural world will be fine without us any more than a mother would be fine if her child died. That's how much Earth loves us.
Let me say this before, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And we are born here of Gaia for a reason. We are part of the evolution of life. And if we fulfill our purpose as a species, that purpose is to contribute to the constant aliveness and coming alive of the planet. The planet has become more and more alive over the last few billion years. And we're meant to contribute to that.
Yeah.
And so I think that the crisis is not actually about whether human beings survive or not. In that regard, I kind of side with the technological optimists that say our ingenuity is unlimited. We can manage somehow. If the soil is all destroyed, we can grow food in hydroponics factories. We can grow meat in big vats. We can maybe someday synthesize food. We don't need nature. We can control the climate by spraying the skies and making big machines to suck down carbon. We can make bubble cities. We can have air conditioning if it gets too hot. Like, we don't need nature. What if they're right? That's my fear. It's not that they're wrong. My fear is that they're right. And if that is true, if we are to fulfill our destiny, which is to contribute to life and not survive on a dying planet, then we are not going to be able to rely on survival fear to change us. Climate change is not going to come to the rescue and make us change our ways. It's not going to come to the rescue and make us fulfill all of the yearnings that the protesters from Occupy to Extinction Rebellion to Hong Kong, wherever they are seeking. Instead, we're going to have to actually choose to enter into our collective soul purpose. We're not going to be forced into it. And what then comes to me is, what are the conditions of this choice?
Yeah.
How are we going to start choosing that? Because what I see, whether it's Occupy, Extinction Rebellion, Hong Kong, like all of these protests, this beautiful upwelling of energy to serve a more beautiful world, it gets hijacked. It gets diverted onto old storylines of us versus them. And it becomes the protesters versus the police. They have to set up an enemy, set up a bad guy in order to define themselves against and then to fight. And then you know the story. You know, there's some of the protesters become violent, the police crack down, each side blames the other, the public gets disaffected, and you have martyrs who are, you know, among themselves, have lots of solidarity, and they're all, yes, we're doing this, you know, this sacred cause, we're these revolutionaries, but they don't actually change anything. And the machine trundles on as it has. If we want a different result than that, then we have to let go of the storyline of good versus evil, and we have to let go of all of the strategies and tactics and rhetorics that come along with that. And we have to understand that our goals are too big to put into demands, and that really our purpose is to change the conditions of our collective choices. And that means to propagate healing in society, because a lot of our choices come from trauma of various kinds, and to propagate worldviews and beliefs and stories and experiences of love, of connection, of forgiveness, of generosity. Like, these experiences form a new foundation for systems that will be built as the existing systems come under increasing stress. So that's kind of the, yeah, that's my political program.
Yeah. That is glorious. That is beautiful. I'm really glad it's 11:30 at night for me, because I'm just going to go straight into this tonight to contemplate and unravel and just be with. I hear what you're saying, but your words are creating pictures. Your words are creating places in my mind that I have not seen before. So it's like you're passing the map, and it's coming online for the very first time. And I've always been so excited by the third option. I know duality is not the answer. The third option always reveals the way. And you have shown me the third option, because my heart has been behind the protest. And of course I see the other side and I'm like, God, I don't understand. What is the way? What is the way? Mm-hmm. I see the way, Charles. I certainly can't articulate it yet, but I see it, and that seed yes. will grow.
That's the breeze that's stirring.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes, yeah. yes.
Yes.
Well, I would like to wrap this up here, because you have shared so much, and I would love for everybody to just let this filter through and to keep the conversation going. And who knows, we might have another one. Is there anything more you would like to share before we go?
No, I would just thank you for your enthusiastic and generous listening for your humility and your huge heart.
Thank you, Charles. And I think what I take from you at this moment, at this early stage, is we cannot yet say what we want, but by golly, we feel it.
We cannot say, but we recognize it.
Yeah.
We recognize it. When we get a glimpse of it, we recognize that yeah. is a piece of what we want.
Yes.
But to weave it into a whole story.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. We're not there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Great.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
What an honor to actually spend a little bit of time with you and to have this conversation.
Thanks, Anaya.
Yeah, God bless to you and your family. May peace be with you, as they say here in Cathar, France.
Likewise.